TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Welfare Ranching and Point Reyes National Seashore. George Werthner's historic exposé of the destruction of the American West by cattle grazing and the shocking desertion by the National Park Service in September 2021 to continue and even expand beef and dairy cattle grazing in the popular national park just north of San Francisco, on the unceded land of the Coast Miwok people. Cattle grazing should have ended there in the late 1980s. The area had become a national park by an act of Congress in 1962, and the existing ranches were bought out at market rate with taxpayer funds. The ranchers were given 25 years to find new land and vacate. Instead, they expanded the herds and used political pull in Senate and Congress to extend the leases. The biologist, former Bureau of Land Management employee, author, editor of Welfare Ranching, George Werthner, deplored the September 21 decision. He wrote, "Point Reyes was a spectacular landscape of open prairies and patches of woodlands, home to 460 species, 876 plants, and many different marine and terrestrial mammals. In addition, it harbors 100 listed rare, threatened, and endangered species, an incredible diversity given the seashore's relatively small size. This biological diversity prompted UNESCO in 1988 to designate Point Reyes as an international biosphere reserve. All this is threatened and the damage increases. Among the impacts caused by the ongoing livestock operations is the trampling and pollution of the park's waterways, increased soil erosion, the spread of exotic weeds. Indeed, one stream in the park has some of the highest coliform bacteria counts found along the entire California coast. This plan is in direct violation of the law creating the park." That was an opinion piece by George Werthner, written in September 2021. And this is where matters stand at the end of September, and the case is headed to the courts. Almost 17 years earlier, I met George Werthner a few miles south of Point Reyes, in the Marin Headlands. He gave a talk that moved and surprised me and changed my understanding of cattle ranching. The book, Welfare Ranching, had just been released. He is co-author and editor. In essays and photos, Welfare Ranching reveals the practices that are ripping apart the ecological fabric of the arid West. Subsidized livestock grazing occurs on more than 300 million acres of publicly owned land. Taxpayer dollars are used to turn the West into a giant feedlot for cattle and sheep. Werthner is an ecologist, author of many books and papers, photographer, wildlands advocate, and university instructor. He is George Werthner.
Grazing is so ubiquitous, it happens on most of the private lands and most of the public lands in the West. 90% of the BLM, Bureau of Land Management lands are grazed, at least for grazing. 69% of the Forest Service lands are leased for grazing, and they'd be more except that some places are so dense with trees that they don't graze them. Even some of the National Wildlife Refuge lands as well as National Park lands are grazed. So we have very few places without livestock grazing as controls. So we don't have very many places where people can go and see what an ungrazed place looks like. Even things like wildlife refuges, the only thing you see in the background is cattle. And this is a national park, Grand Teton National Park, where grazing still occurs. And these do not happen without effects. For example, in Grand Teton National Park, a couple years ago, they killed a grizzly bear in the national park because it had killed a cow. being grazed in the park. And you say to yourself, well, what is a park for? Is the park have, at least in my view, the park is set aside for things like grizzly bears. And yet the way it gets managed when you have livestock is that becomes the priority thing. Now, I mentioned earlier that most of the breeds of cattle that are used in the West are slow moving, and they also like being near places that are sort of wet because they evolved in moist woodlands in Eurasia, and that's the kind of habitat that they seek out. And in the West, most of this kind of habitat tends to be the stream bottoms and what are called the riparian areas, and that's the green belt that's affected by water. In fact, in a lot of parts of the West, like 70-80% of the forage that you'll find on a grazing allotment will be associated with riparian areas, and often shade too if there's trees. So our riparian areas in the West, which support 75-80% of all wildlife species, are also the very places that livestock tend to congregate and have had serious effects. For example, Sheldon Wildlife Refuge in Nevada, this area used to be a wet meadow. And now it's a sagebrush-filled place because of downcutting. The stream channel has cut down, and eventually the roots of the willows and other species that used to be found here couldn't reach the water table and then disappeared and sagebrush invaded. This used to be a wet meadow with aspen and beaver. It was an old beaver dam in the sagebrush. When this stream, which has been grazed for well over 100 years, goes into an exclosure, a place that hasn't been grazed because it's been fenced. In the ungrazed parts of the streams that are like that, you have far more trout and they tend to be bigger. Well, having more trout and bigger trout has other implications besides how it affects fishermen. Animals that depend on fish are affected. So if you have less fish and they're not as big, you have less river otter, you have less mink, you have less food for things like bald eagles and osprey or anything else that's dependent on fish. It's not just the fish that are affected, of course. There's all sorts of other aquatic animals and vertebrates and invertebrates that are affected. Now, the effect on riparian areas can also have other impact. Now, we're looking upstream at this area that's grazed. There's no willows hardly at all down here, and there's just big cottonwood trees. There's no young cottonwood trees. And then I'm going to turn around and show you this side of the fence looking downstream, which has been fenced from grazing for 7 years. And this is what the same stream looks like. It's gotten much narrower. It has all sorts of young trees and older trees growing up on the edge of the banks, has much more shade and bank stability. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, I visited the same site. And I went there, and these trees are much bigger now. And there is all sorts of logs and stuff caught and jammed in here. It's stabilizing the stream banks as a result of the bigger trees that are growing there that are now acting as little blocks on the water flow. And lots of studies have shown that, like the San Pedro River, for example, in Arizona, which is very close to this area, they closed off to grazing in 1984, and they've shown, you know, like 200% increase in migratory songbird nesting in that area as a result of the vegetation changes resulting from the elimination of livestock. Now, another effect that's happened is in a lot of parts of the, particularly the Southwest, we've lost a lot of these large trees, and because they're you know, they die and they get knocked over by the stream or whatever. And in many places of the Southwest, they're not being replaced because the young trees all get eaten, the saplings and seedlings get eaten by livestock, so that the bigger trees are not being replaced. And these big trees are important for all sorts of things. Not only do they, you know, act as debris that protects stream channels and provide fish habitat when they fall in the stream, but they also, while they're existing, they're important for nesting habitat for things like bald eagles, or, and this is one of those kind of things that you never think about, red bats in the Southwest roost in the bark under the larger cottonwood trees. So red bats are in decline in the Southwest, partly because of the loss of the old cottonwood trees, which aren't being replaced. So, you know, you wouldn't think about bats being impacted by livestock production, but in fact, it has those kinds of repercussions through the ecosystem. I just saw a study that was done on New Mexico, which analyzed the bird species for New Mexico that were listed as endangered or threatened. And there were 91% of the species on that list, livestock production was involved. 91% of the bird species. And largely because a lot of them are real dependent on that riparian habitat. Now, here's another thing that you don't think about. Irrigation, besides the cattle using the water in the stream, we take a lot of water out of streams in the West to grow hay and alfalfa. And these hay and alfalfa fields have all sorts of impacts. Of course, the dewatering stream is one, which I'll address in a minute, but even the fact that you've eliminated the native vegetation and replaced it with this exotic vegetation, that has fragmented and eliminated native plant communities, which of course subsequent impacts on all sorts of wildlife as a result. And it's a pretty significant amount of land. In Montana, where I used to live, for example, looking at aerial photographs and looking at different vegetation types, so it's very accurate. They can tell down to a 30 by 30 meter square area what the habitat or land use is. And 5.5 million acres in Montana are used for hay fields alone. 5.5 million acres. Now, to give you a perspective on that, the amount of land that's urbanized and developed in Montana is 0.17%. In other words, 1/5 of 1% of Montana is highways, malls, and housing tracts. And 5.5 million acres, which is about 6% of Montana, is in hay fields. This is has a negative impact. So I want you to, when you see these hay fields, or even here in California, drive up the Central Valley from Sacramento to Redding, and what you're going to see on both sides of the highway, besides rice paddies, is going to be hay fields. And it goes for miles and miles and hundreds of miles. Well, in all these western states, the single greatest use of water is for irrigation, not for public use, and that includes in California. But like, let's look at Nevada, the driest state in the nation. 90% of all the water in the state goes for irrigation. And Nevada produces the same amount of beef as Vermont. Hardly, a major beef producer, yet we've sacrificed most of Nevada's landscape, because almost all the public lands are leased for livestock grazing, and well as most of the private land, using scarce water to grow livestock feed. And it's not like California, where some of the irrigation, you know, grows lettuce or something else. We're talking about almost 100% of the water use in Nevada is for hay. In Montana, 97.5% of all the water used in the state goes for agriculture. And again, in Montana, what do we grow there? It's cold. We grow mostly hay. And so that has serious consequences on streams, dewatering streams, and also wetlands. A lot of the wetlands in California, Oregon, and so forth that were drained to grow alfalfa. You've heard of the big issue with the Klamath Basin on the Oregon-California border. Most of that Klamath Basin farmland was created by draining former wetlands to grow crops like alfalfa and hay, fed to livestock, and with serious consequences for waterfowl. The other consequence of course, the irrigation use is that we dam rivers, and the damming of rivers fragments these aquatic ecosystems, just like housing tracts will fragment habitat here on a slope in, you know, the sides of the mountains here near San Francisco or something. And the fragmentation, it can be several things. One, you can't have, things don't move up and down anymore of the river, and that affects species like migrating salmon and so forth. And also the water changes, because the water is, it doesn't flood anymore. There are various changes in the water quality and quantity that affect a lot of aquatic vertebrates as a result of dams. And most of the dams in the West, even though they're justified for hydroelectric or recreation, oh, we're going to go run motorboats on it or whatever, they wouldn't be built in the first place if it wasn't for the motivation to provide storage for irrigation. This is another way that water and cattle affect things. A lot of the springs, I'm talking about cold springs, and seeps in the West, which are also very important for all sorts of animals. For example, all kinds of endemic snails in the West that have very limited distribution that are often associated with just very small drainages or a few springs and so forth. But there's frogs, there's birds and so forth that depend on these springs. And when they get developed like this for watering livestock, there's no vegetation around it, cover. They become places that a lot of wildlife won't use anymore, or they use and they become population sinks. Now, if you're a small mammal or a rodent or a bird, ground nesting bird, and or an amphibian, that's not good habitat left for you. And a lot of places in the West, I saw one survey that was done of the Owyhee Canyon country, where I used to live, actually, used to work for the BLM. There are like 3,000 seeps and springs there that are developed for livestock production. Almost every single spring has this kind of impact on it. So there are very few that are left in a natural condition. Well, there's one other effect of having cattle being attracted to these water things, is they poop. And since they spend so much time near these waterways, they're also the major source of water pollution in the West, non-point water pollution. Okay, so that's impacts on water. Many, many ways that livestock protection affects water and the wildlife and water qualities associated with that. Then there's soils. In a lot of the West, in fact, it's true even in the East, but it's not as noticeable, there's what they call these biocrusts. And these biocrusts live on the soil surface and have a number of functions. One, they prevent soil erosion by, they have these little like filaments that embed among the soil particles that hold it together. And on top of that, they fix nitrogen from the air and put it down into the soil. And they also have a unique thing in that they prevent weedy annual species from establishing in a lot of cases, because perennial grasses tend to have larger seeds and annual grasses tend to have smaller seeds. In a place where you have a lot of biocrust, the annual grasses or other annual plants do not have enough biomass in their seeds to get roots down into the soil very deep before they die, dry up, or whatever. So where you have a lot of these biocrusts, there tend to be less of annual establishment. Whereas the perennial grasses, which were native to a lot of the western part of the United States, have bigger seeds, and they will sit on the surface here, and if there's a crack because of frost or whatever, they have enough energy in their seed to get down through that. So what it does is it tends to favor the perennials, the native species, over the annuals. Well, when you have the cattle come in here, or sheep as the case may be, and they trample all these biocrusts, well, then you favor the annuals. Another effect of livestock production, you have the animals out there, these domestic animals carry disease that are detrimental to native wildlife. So you have like bighorn sheep in the West, and a lot of places are no longer found because they get disease from domestic sheep that has killed off the herds. And a lot of places we can't reintroduce the bighorn sheep because of the presence of domestic livestock. In fact, I just read about in Montana, where I used to live, one Forest Service agency just signed an agreement with some of the sheep ranchers that graze on our public land to allow the owner of the sheep to shoot bighorn sheep on site that come near their herds. And the reason they signed this agreement is that the Fish and Game in Montana wanted to reintroduce some bighorn sheep in this one mountain range, which is grazed by domestic livestock. And so the guys that own the sheep there say, well, the only way we're going to go with this is if you let us kill any sheep that come near our sheep. You know, just the fact that they had that kind of power to me is disturbing. But the fact is that there were actually two other mountain ranges that the Fish and Game wanted to reintroduce the bighorn in because they were better habitat than the one they finally did reintroduce them. And the reason they didn't is because the rancher said, well, we're not going to let you do it there. And this is on our public land. This all goes behind the scenes that you don't know about. And I even saw this when I worked for the BLM. I'll tell you one story. I remember one of the first things I had to do was help designate what they were called Areas of Critical Environmental Concern, ACECs. And I went out for the day, well, actually a week, and I surveyed this inventory of this area, came back in, I drew my maps and so forth, I submitted to my boss. And this area was a canyon with uplands that had never been grazed, benches that had never been grazed, beautiful blue bunch wheatgrass, grasslands, and then a beautiful riparian area. In the riparian area, the cattle couldn't get into because there were waterfalls upstream and downstream for about 2 miles. So this riparian bottom was in really good shape. And I drew the map to include the uplands, too. And I handed it to my boss, and he calls me into his office a couple days later, and he says, you did a great job on this inventory. This is, you got all the, you know, good attributes, and this really makes sense to set this aside. But I altered your map slightly, and he shows it to me, and he says, I drew the lines right here at the canyon rim. And I said, well, but you got all these bunch grasses up above that have never been grazed. It's a great place to have as a control that we can look at. He said, yeah, but if the ranchers see that there's a bunch grasses there, they're not going to approve of this. And I said, but you can't even, they can't graze it now. There's no water there. He said, but they're going to think someday we might get water there, and then we'll be able to graze it. And so they're not going to approve this. And if they don't approve it, the state director won't sign off on this, so you won't get it. So we then change the boundaries to fit the canyon thing, and that's what we sent out for public comment, you know, us the biologists with our idea of what was the best thing for this landscape, already compromised before it even got out for public comment by that influence. Now we got predator control. As you know, in a lot of the West, coyotes and other animals are trapped regularly all the time, even though there's a lot of studies that show that even predator control doesn't do any good in the end, because, well, partly, this is another one of those stories about lack of controls. There's only two places where there isn't significant predator control, Yellowstone Park and the Hanford Energy Site in Washington. And in both places there, coyotes act a lot like wolves. They form territories, they live a long time, they produce very few young. In places where you exploit them, where they're trapped, shot, and poisoned, they produce a lot of young, and they're inexperienced, so they tend to be much more likely actually to take livestock. So it's a self-defeating purpose. But nevertheless, we kill thousands, tens of thousands of coyotes every year, satisfy the livestock industry. And we also kill wolves. We're trying to reintroduce wolves in many places in the West. And the Yellowstone area is an area I worked in for a long time. And every wolf pack whose territory overlaps largely with livestock has been either killed or controlled, removed in some way. They don't survive for more than a few years at most. And the only place we're going to have wolves constantly without management constant interference is going to be in the places, the few places that don't have livestock. So if you want to have wolves in more than just a few token national parks, and wolves are an important evolutionary force, you want to restore them in a lot of places, not just because they're wolves, just because it's nice to think that there's wolves there, but because of the predation by a large animal like this is important to many species. We need to restore that evolutionary process, just like in a lot of places we need to restore fire. Another thing is what they call pest control. Prairie dogs have been just devastated throughout the Great Plains and elsewhere where they're found. There's five species of prairie dogs in the West, but the largest one is black-tailed prairie dog, but all of them have suffered. And black-tailed prairie dogs and others have been poisoned because ranchers consider them competition. And this has had negative impacts on all sorts of other species. There's about 148 species that are known to be dependent on prairie dog towns. So when you eliminate prairie dog towns, you affect things like black-footed ferrets, you affect things like burrowing owls, and they are all negatively on the decline too. Black-footed ferret is listed, the burrowing owl may soon be listed, and mountain plover is another listed species that's dependent on prairie dog towns. So pest control is another thing that happens as a result of livestock production. Then there's social displacement. I mean, in a lot of places, a lot of species, elk is one in particular that's been well studied, elk will not graze in the same place with cattle if they can help it. If they have any choice, they will move to another place. Now, they might come in there after the cattle have left, but they will not be there at the same time, so they're displaced. And, you know, animals don't just go, I mean, they're using the best habitat. They're in a place because they think and they know or whatever that that is the best habitat. So if they get displaced out of that, they're going into less suitable habitat, more marginal habitat, which affects their overall, you know, ability to survive. Going beyond public lands, just to sort of get this into a broader contextual framework, almost all livestock, well, I'm talking about cattle in particular, these days are fed, some finished off with crops, particularly crops like corn, soybeans, and so forth. The single greatest crop that we grow is corn, and this is 70 million acres here was harvested, 80 million acres were planted. California is 100 million acres, 103 million acres. So imagine everything in California from, say, Redding south to the Mexican border, from Nevada to the Pacific Ocean, nothing but a cornfield. That's how much land we use to grow corn that's fed to livestock. But that's not the only crop we do. We also grow soybeans, of which, despite tofu and all that stuff, 95% of all soybeans goes for animal feed. And we planted 77 million acres last year. 77 million acres. So we've got 80 million acres and 77 million acres just in those two crops. And then hay. Hay of all types. They harvested, but planted considerably more, but harvested 61 million acres. Oregon is 60 million acres. All of Oregon, from the Pacific Ocean to Idaho border, Washington to California, nothing but a hayfield. I mean, we're talking about impacts. You start putting this forage together, and it's all going for livestock feed, and you start thinking about how much land is affected, you'll find that between the lands that are grazed, the lands that are pasture, the lands that are crops that are grows, in my estimation, I've tried to add these things up, though nobody accounts for them specifically that way, and it's about 70% of the land area in the lower 48 states that's used for animal agriculture. And to put that into perspective, all the urbanization in the country, talking about all the cities, the highways, the malls, affects 3.5% of the country. A really significant impact on the landscape has to do with agriculture, but most of the agriculture is for animal agriculture, and most of that is for livestock. So when you go across the middle part of the country, and I just drove it on the way to Vermont last year, and when you're going across Nebraska and Iowa and Illinois and Indiana and Ohio, this is what you see for mile after mile after mile. And unrelenting. So I have a final thing is, you know, I've sort of alluded to it, housing tracts and so forth are a big impact. They fragment habitat, they introduce weedy species, they affect wildlife, they are a source of pollution and so forth. And in places that are growing around the West, like California, you're really familiar with, most of the people in the West live in urban areas, so we see this stuff all the time. So we're aware of these impacts, and we should be. And we try to do things about them and try to prevent these things from where they occur through zoning and through conservation easements and so forth. But we practically ignore the much larger effect on the West of livestock production. You can see when you look at a map of the West, it is grazed or affected by livestock production. Now, the degree on any particular acre may not be the same, but when you look at the cumulative impacts, as I've tried to point out, and you figure that that's happening on hundreds of millions of acres, it becomes quite significant. Of public lands in the West, Nevada is the fastest growing state right now in the West. In fact, I think in the country. And so if you look at the impacts in Nevada, you say, what's impacting Nevada? Las Vegas is not a pretty sight. But in terms of what's affecting the state as a whole, livestock production is far more serious menace to the biodiversity in Nevada than that urbanization. And I'm not saying the urbanization isn't something to be concerned about. I'm just trying to shift the focus so that we focus on both of these things as issues. Of course, the ways to deal with the urbanization, we have things. We have zoning and planning, we have conservation easement, we can outright fee purchase to protect this habitat, but we haven't dealt effectively with the livestock production and how to limit that. And I would submit to you that eliminating livestock on most of the public lands in the West, if not all of them, would have significant benefits both for the land itself as well as for taxpayers and the subsidies that we would avoid direct, as well as the indirect externalities. Because one of the ways that livestock producers in the West compete elsewhere is that a lot of their impacts that I just talked about, the impacts on water, the impacts on soil, the impacts on wildlife, and so forth, are not really paid for by themselves. So, you know, I have this vision of what the West could be like. And I'm not saying it's going to go back to what it was when Lewis and Clark went there. We can't go back to that. But we can certainly get a lot of areas restored where we can have things like bison and elk in a lot of people's backyards close rather than just distant things in the distance, where we can have streams that are filled with trout and salmon, where we have streams that flow in the summertime instead of drying up, and where we can restore things like wolves to the landscape across the whole West. And so this is the kind of the vision that I see as an alternative to the present livestock production use of these lands. And particularly on public lands, we have a say on that. Our public lands are one of the few places where we can save a lot of endangered species and provide a habitat for them. So that's why the focus on the public lands and why I think it's critical that we eliminate or at least seriously reduce the number of livestock on public lands, because we can do more for wildlife and biodiversity in this country than just about anything else we can do so easily, affecting so few people for so little cost. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
That was George Werthner on welfare ranching, the taxpayer-funded destruction of the American West. I recorded him in December 2004 on the Marin Headlands. George Werthner is an ecologist, writer, photographer, wildlands advocate, and university instructor with 26 titles on natural history and related topics to his credit. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.